What if I refused to talk until I had a lawyer present? I would have a lot of time to think about my situation. That was the last time I walked in anywhere as a free man for the next 11 years.
Detective Galden told me I was under arrest. They had warrants out for first-degree burglary, rape, and sexual offense. He and another detective, a skinny, chain-smoking guy named Lowe, advised me of my rights while I read along on a form, initializing each paragraph to show I understood.
I don't need an attorney, sir. I didn't commit this crime, and I want to get it straight. I signed, indicating I was waiving my rights in front of Detective Lowe. I remember thinking, why would I need a lawyer when I haven't done anything wrong? I just wanted to get this over with so they'd see they'd made a mistake. Let's talk about this weekend, Ron, Detective Galden said. He was a clean-cut guy, pretty young to be a detective. He ran his hands through his hair a lot like he was real proud of it. Where were you Saturday night, the evening of July 28th? I was 22 years old. I didn't give a lot of thought to my days and nights and what distinguished them from one another, especially in the summer where time just seemed to run together. I went where the party was. I tried to think real hard about the night they were asking about. I told Galden I had been hanging out with my brother Calvin at the boarding house on Ireland Street where he was living, and I told the detective we were drinking beer and listening to music. Then I walked over to my friend's place down the road where we drank some more. Do you smoke? Galden interrupted. Yeah, I said. Was that a crime? He stared at me, waiting for something. Newports, I told him. He made some kind of note, twisting his mouth to the side like he was sucking meat out of his teeth while he thought on something. He nodded for me to continue. I was there until about 10:20 p.m. Then I went back to Calvin's. Then me and my friend went out to the Candlelight Club. I stayed there for a while, then I ran into Janice at the club, another friend of mine, and asked her for a ride home because it was raining. About what time was that? 2:30 or 3 in the morning? He asked me for the names of the people I had seen at the club, people who could verify I was there, writing down what I was saying. But I noticed he wasn't recording the conversation, so I felt that he could be writing down anything. Then Detective Galden asked me to continue with what had happened when I had left the club. Janice gave me the keys, and I drove us back to the boarding house. She went inside, and another friend of ours came out and needed a ride home. Said he'd give me a dollar to drive him. I took him home and went back to the boarding house. Janice was waiting outside with our friend Jake, who wanted a ride to his uncle's. He and Janice got in, and we dropped him off. Then Janice brought me home. To 35 Oak Circle? Yeah. Then me and Janice talked some, and I went in and went to bed. What time was that? Round 4. Did anyone see you come in? No, they were all asleep. I went into the downstairs bedroom and fell asleep on the bed. Galden made me go through the whole thing again, asking me for details and times. After he finished interrogating me, he opened the door to the hallway and I waited for Lowe. My sister Diane passed by. She must have decided to come by after she stopped by my mom's and heard what was going on. Her face was bunched up with worry, and I hated being responsible for that. But I was glad she had come down, too, even if I couldn't talk to her. Next, Detective Lowe questioned me. I felt like I was saying the same things over and over. Why weren't they getting it? We took a break at 4:15. It had been over 3 hours since I had been in there. I realized Tootie and my girlfriend must have left a while ago to get the car back. I wish I had hugged each of them before I went upstairs with the detectives, but the police might have taken it as a sign I knew I was guilty, saying goodbye and all. I was allowed a bathroom break, and an officer watched me as I washed my hands afterward. I pressed them, cold and wet to my face, trying to calm the panic revving inside me. Why was this taking so long? When I went back into the room, there was an older cop, Detective Sullivan, who everybody called Sully, standing in there with Detectives Galden and Lowe. He was the one who had watched me from the window as I crossed the parking lot and started up the steps. Suddenly it triggered something, and I went back in my mind to being about 12, standing on my grandma's porch on Shepherd Street in Burlington. I used to want to be a cop, so when I saw a police officer in action chasing three black kids from the high school, I thought it was one of the most exciting things I'd ever seen. I watched when he caught up with one of them and tackled him to the ground. Then the cop placed the muzzle of his gun on the back of the kid's head and said, "If you breathe too hard, I'll blow your head off." Sully looked like that cop. They slammed my black canvas World Cup shoes on the table. I used to wear them to mop up the floors at Summer Seafood. One time I spilled the dirty water all over them, and I threw them in the washing machine trying to clean them. The insoles started coming apart, but I didn't care. They were just work shoes. "You recognize these?" said one of the detectives, holding them up. They were split, cut on the soles all the way from the toe to the heel. "Yeah, they look like my shoes, but they weren't in that condition," I replied. They pulled out a plastic bag with a small piece of dark foam. "You see this piece of material? This came from your shoe, and we found it in Jennifer Thompson's apartment the night you raped her." "That's because you put it there then." "I don't know any Jennifer. I never been in her apartment," I said. Then they held up my red flashlight. "This your flashlight?" "Yeah." "You know what kind of batteries are in here?" "I haven't the slightest idea," I said. "Well, that's because you stole this from Mary Reynolds and held it in her face when you raped her." I shook my head no. "I haven't done nothing like that." "Cotton, Jennifer Thompson already identified you. We know it was you." "No, no, you got the wrong guy." It felt like the walls were closing in on me. My blood was boiling, the heat spread over me, my muscles tensed with anger. I had an impulse to grab this cop by the collar and slam him against the wall. Maybe then he'd listen to me. But I bit the inside of my cheek, knowing that doing something like that would have made everything worse. They would have just piled on more charges. "Oh, really?" said Sully. He leaned in real close to me, his nose bent like he smelled shit. He had a real cocky attitude. "What about the time you served in juvie for breaking and entering with intent to rape?" he said, throwing some paper at me. "She was a little white girl, too." Here it comes, I thought. That old case that wouldn't go away. When I was 16, I liked this girl, Evie, the younger sister of my friend Jeff. We had messed around some before, but one night I had been out drinking, and I walked into their house and into Evie's bedroom. I slipped into bed with her, thinking we could fool around. I startled her so much she hollered. Her mom caught us and pointed a shotgun at me. "I can shoot you now," she said, "or we can let the police deal with you." They charged me with breaking and entering with intent to commit rape. Then the charges were dropped, and I thought it was all over. A year later, I was playing ball in Glenraven and stopped at the store to buy some drinks afterward. On the way out the store, I passed my mom.
"You remember that sheriff?" she said. "He's looking for you again on those charges. Said they had spelled Evie's name wrong or something."
It didn't make any sense to me, and I thought maybe my mother had gotten things mixed up. But the next morning, she came knocking on my bedroom door. "Ron, the police are here. Just get it over with." I jumped up and got dressed. I walked downstairs and out the door, and the two cops handcuffed me right there on the front steps and put me in the car. My dog, King, a black collie, was laying there with his chin on the stoop, just looking at me. So sad. Mom said the day I left home, King took off, and they never did see him anymore. They locked me up, and a court-appointed attorney came down to see me. You're looking at 50 to 95 years, Ronald. But I can get you a plea bargain for 3 years, and if you behave, you'll get out even sooner than that. I tried to tell him I didn't do anything, but he told me it didn't matter. It was her word against mine, and he scared me up real bad. I really didn't want to plead guilty, but I didn't think I had much choice. The attorney said it was my best chance. I wouldn't have to go to trial or anything. So I took the plea and spent 18 months at Polk Youth Center in Raleigh. When I got out, I made a couple more stupid mistakes. I got caught breaking and entering and had just gotten out of prison in February 84. I told myself this was it. It was time for me to grow up and make something of myself. My sisters tried to tell me I wasn't running with the right crowd, and maybe they were right. But that still didn't make me guilty of what these cops were saying I did. This cop, Sully, though, he had already decided I was guilty. I'll never forget him saying, "Saw your girlfriend earlier. You think you're Mr. Big Shot going around town screwing white women, don't you? We got your ass." I knew they were trying to get me to break, but it wasn't going to be like that. I wasn't going to make it easy for them. I looked Sully real steady in the eye. Like a lot of people in town, he didn't like the fact that I had dated white girls. Sometimes, walking around, you could feel the racism like a pilot light, always on in the back of people's minds, flickering, and just waiting to get turned up. "I know why y'all are doing what you're doing, but just because I date a white girl doesn't mean I'm going to go out and commit this crime because my girlfriend didn't come over that night." He glared at me. I clammed up after that. I knew it was a losing battle. Anything I said, they were just going to use against me. Sully opened the door and called in a uniformed officer. "Lock 'em up," he said, pointing to me like I was trash that needed to be put out. The Burlington PD didn't have a holding cell, so they handcuffed me and led me out the door on the side, not the public entrance I had come in before, and put me in a cruiser. I went before the magistrate and was placed under $150,000 bond, and then they took me to the county jail in Graham. Alamance County Jail was a cesspool, and it smelled like it. It was an old building that was always having problems with the plumbing, and the odor in August when I arrived was fierce. After they took all my personal belongings and put them in a brown envelope, they issued me a navy blue jumpsuit, kind of like a mechanic's outfit, and allowed me to make 2 calls. The first person I rang up was my father, who kept his head about such things. "Hang in there, son. I'll come visit you real soon," he told me. "If they get your bond down to $50,000, I'll see what I can do to get you out of there." Next, I called my mother. She was much more emotional. She came right down with deodorant and some soap, a legal pad, and M&Ms. Back then, they let family do things like that. "I didn't do it," I told her. She cried. She was holding the piece of paper the police had left at her apartment, with a drawing of the suspect and a description of the crimes. "I just got to wait. They'll see I wasn't there," I told her. "Lots of people saw me, Mom. I was with Calvin, and then we went to the Candlelight Club." "Ron, what are you talking about? You were right at home. I read the date right here. Your sister's son saw you sleeping on my couch all night." "What do you mean?" I asked. "You got the days mixed up. Don't you remember Diane Snipes dropped off Tracy at the house? You opened the door for her, and Joe and your sister Puddin' saw you sleeping on the couch." My heart started pounding. My mother was right. I had gotten my weekends confused, which meant the alibi I gave to police was not going to check out at all. "I'll be back as soon as I can, Ron. Make sure you eat in here. You got to keep your strength up." She had the same look on her face that she had had years ago,
when I was 16 years old and the cops came for me. A strong black woman utterly powerless when someone else was making all the rules. That night I dreamed about the old white house in Glenraven. It had a big wood stove where my mom used to cook a vegetable soup that would last for days. When I got older, I realized she made it because she had so many heads to feed. But we loved it. We couldn't get enough. The house had 3 bedrooms, and my sisters, Diane and Tootie, and my brothers, Calvin and Terry, and I used to run all over the place together. Calvin, whom everybody called Cotton, was the oldest, followed by Diane. Tootie was just a couple of years younger than me, and she followed me around everywhere the way I followed my brother Calvin. Terry, the youngest, did his best to tag along, but I usually told him to get lost, stay home with my mom. At 4 years younger than me, he was still the baby, and she was very protective. That was lucky for him, because he never had trouble with the law like Calvin and me. As kids, our favorite place to play was out in the woods. It was shady and cool in the summer, and there was a big pond behind the old Fairstone fabric mill where you could swim. There was a rope hanging from a branch of a nearby tree, and you could pull it way back and jump on it like Tarzan and swing way out over the pond. We'd drop off like stones, plunking down into the dark water. We'd walk back barefoot, searching for wild grapes called muscadines, our wet shins getting streaked with mud from the creeks. In school, when we learned about Thanksgiving, we learned that Alamance County got its name from the local Native American word for that mud, which was kind of bluish. I always remembered that because my grandmother on my father's side was a full-blooded Cherokee, so that meant I had Indian blood myself. Once, when we went swimming behind the mill, I felt a cool breeze threading around my ankles, a current that felt like it was going to pull me under. I swam as hard and as fast as I could to get out of there, and I never did go back in. A lot of people ended up drowning there, and I think it was finally drained. But I still love the taste of muscadines. When I pop one in my mouth, the sweet burst is like a taste of freedom. In the Graham jail, the only time you got out of your cell was for church on Saturdays or visitations on Sundays. A woman named Annie Mae Dickey came in to play the piano, and a few people from the Gideon organization performed the church service. The music was the best part. I loved to sing. When I was young, I would pat out a beat on my legs or a table, anywhere I could, really, and I'd try to get my sisters to sing along with me. Sometimes it was a song we all knew from the radio. Other times I just made up my own songs and tried to teach them the words. I shared the cell for a while with this guy, Fearno. He was a white guy with red hair and freckles, a small-time thief whose crimes probably had more to do with boredom than a criminal mind. He had been caught breaking and entering, and after he was arrested, he broke down in the interrogation room and confessed to a whole bunch more B&Es, 64 counts in total. He was crazy for a girl named Wendy. So crazy in love that the thought of being separated from her for whatever time he was going to have to serve was undoing him. One night, I woke just as he was about to hang himself. He had slashed his blanket with a razor and braided it into a rope, and he was sweating buckets and sobbing. I talked him down the best I could. "It's not worth it, man. You want to never see her again? You can't kill yourself and put that on her. What's she going to do?" We were tight after that, but about a month in, my court-appointed attorney, Mr. Mosley, told me that Fearno had given a statement to the police. "Says you were talking in your sleep," Mosley explained. "Says he heard you mumbling, 'Shut up or I'll cut you. It's been a long time, baby. Your man's in Germany, ain't he?'" I guess Fearno was trying to make himself a deal. I had made the mistake of telling him about the lineup. The week after my arrest, they brought me back to the station for a lineup, where I was told to walk forward, turn 180 degrees to the right, and then read a statement off a card. "Shut up, or I'll cut you. Hey, baby, how you doing?
Your man's over in Germany. It's been a long time. There were 7 of us standing there. I was number 5. The detectives and my attorney, Phil, stood in the back of the room while some of the officers were sitting down with Ms. Thompson. There was no partition, and I could see she was young, blonde, and trying to act tough. When I walked forward, I was so nervous I messed up and said, "Shut up or I'll cue you." Ms. Thompson whispered something to Detective Golden, and they asked me and Number 4 standing next to me to repeat the process. This time I got it right. "Shut up or I'll cut you," I said my bit and then stepped back in line. It was like facing the firing squad. "Please don't pick me," I thought. I know they said she identified me from my photograph, but now she saw me in person. I thought maybe she'd see I wasn't the right guy. It would have been all over then. Ms. Thompson wrote something down on a piece of paper and slipped it to Detective Golden. Golden pushed his chair back and brought it over to show to my attorney. I could feel my heart up in my throat. Phil looked at the piece of paper and dropped his head. I knew it then. She had picked me. My hands started sweating and my legs got real wobbly. Ms. Thompson left the room with Golden, and in a little while they brought in the second victim, Ms. Reynolds. They made us do it again for her. I was like a robot. Ms. Reynolds was a lot older than Ms. Thompson, and she wasn't trying to be tough. She was crying and crying and getting hysterical. She wrote something on a piece of paper, and detectives led her out of the room. Later on, Phil told me she picked out the guy standing next to me, Number 4, a college student who lived not too far from the Brookwood Apartments, who wasn't a real suspect. He also told me we had trouble. "You want to tell me again where you were on July 28th and the early morning hours of the 29th? Phil said. I sighed, explaining that I'd mixed up my days. "Ronald is going to look like you lied." "I'm not lying. I didn't do it." But it didn't matter. I was a goner as long as Jennifer Thompson sat there pointing the finger at me. "Yeah, you're innocent," smirked the guards at the jail. "You and everyone else here, right, Cotton?" It was a big joke. On August 28th, I saw Jennifer Thompson again. I went before the court for a probable cause hearing, where they were trying to determine the severity of the charges and whether to turn it over to Superior Court. My attorney had requested bond reduction on the pending charges, but after Jennifer Thompson took the stand and recounted what happened to her, the judge increased the bond on each individual charge to a total of $450,000 and ruled the case would go to Superior Court. I'll never forget that judge, spinning around in his chair. If looks could kill, I'd have been dead then, and maybe better off. With that bond, I was going to remain in Alamance County Jail in Graham until the trial. I turned 23, 4 days before Christmas inside that jail. My whole life was supposed to be ahead of me, but my life looked like it was already over. The trial started in January. Every day I'd go back and forth between the county jail and the big courthouse in Graham. In the courtroom, I sat and listened while Phil tried to argue that the woman had made a mistake. He told the judge that the jury should know about the other woman who had been attacked that night but didn't pick me out of the lineup, even though the police said it was the same guy. But the judge said no. The judge also said no to Phil's request to put a memory expert in front of the jury to testify about how you think you can see something and be sure, but still be wrong. So it wasn't a total surprise when Phil showed up at the county jail and asked me if I wanted to think about pleading out. He stood outside the holding cell I was in. It was bigger than the regular cells, about 10 by 12, and painted kind of pink. The idea was that it helped with your attitude when you were going in and out of the courtroom. "Ron, we got to face the fact here that there's a good chance you'll get convicted," he said. I ran into the district attorney at lunch. "Do you want me to see if we might be able to get a plea bargain?"
He looked out at me from under his dark brows and waited. Despite the bars all around me, I was an innocent man. God knew it, and I knew it, and I would rather die incarcerated than admit to being the rapist they claimed I was. Besides, look what pleading guilty the last time to attempted rape as a juvenile did. Everyone threw it back in my face, and it was one of the main reasons Phil advised me not to take the stand. I told him I wanted to explain my side of things, that I had gotten my dates confused in the beginning when the police asked for my alibi. But Phil said the inconsistent alibi would only give the DA the opportunity to brand me as a liar. No, I told him. I'm not pleading guilty to something I didn't do.
Okay, Ron, Phil said.
Okay. He didn't pressure me to go for a plea bargain the way the other attorney had, though I could see in his eyes it would have been a relief if I had. Instead, we went on with the trial. Phil, always in the perfect suit and perfect tie, argued the best he could. I sat and listened, sometimes bringing my hand to my face. I'd rest my thumb on my chin and my index finger on my mouth, having to stay silent when everyone was just telling a pack of lies about me. During the trial, I would steal a few glances at Jennifer Thompson, thinking, "Why? Why are you doing this?" She just stared back at me with hate. She rolled her eyes at me. The jurors, the DAs, the cops, all of them looked at me like I was something they wanted to spit at and stomp into the ground. In response, I adopted the guarded look I learned long ago when dealing with the authorities, when it seemed like they could do or say whatever they wanted regardless. I knew I was a goner. I just didn't know how bad it was going to be. On January 18, 1985, I was sentenced to life in prison plus 50 years. I stood there as the judge read my sentence. He called me one of the most dangerous men he had ever met. The district attorney said I was a menace to society. I could scarcely look at anyone, but I caught a glimpse of my mom and some of my sisters who were able to make it to the court that day. They were stunned, like someone had just slapped them. I pinched my right arm as hard as I could. The crescent and dent marks on my skin appeared just as the court officers moved in to take me away. This was a nightmare I couldn't wake up from. Chapter 6. Now that the worst had happened, I wanted to get it over with. I didn't want to waste any more time in that god-awful jail. If the rest of my life was going to be in state prison, I wanted to get on with it, whatever it was going to be. Later that day, I wrote a letter to the jailer. "Sir," I wrote, "I've been locked up for a crime I didn't commit. I've been tried, convicted, and sentenced, and I'm ready to go on to serve the sentence. If I don't get out of here, I'm going to start tearing the place apart." The next morning, an officer came to my cell and told me to get my things together. They were taking me to the penitentiary. It was a clear January morning when we drove up to Central Prison, just past downtown Raleigh. It really hit me then, facing that big brick building with a razor wire topped fence all around it. There was no way out. We had to stop at the gate, because only corrections officers can carry weapons inside. The officer inside the gatehouse logged in the vehicle, then my driver turned over his gun. They put it in a holding box and searched the car. The big double gate slid open, like the mouth to hell opening wide to swallow me up. Once we drove in, they took me out of the car and I was walked into the receiving office. They took anything left from my civilian life and put it in a box. I showered, and then was sprayed with a disinfectant, just like a dog getting defleed. I changed into my prison clothes, tan shirt, pants, and a t-shirt, and took the extra set they gave me, and my bed linens. Thankfully, I had my own sneakers. If you couldn't afford your own, they issued you cheap white and black shoes that we called fish heads on account of their being so pointy. I got into an elevator and went up to the second floor. There, they fingerprinted me and took my picture. A guard escorted me down a long corridor that connected the buildings, then through a door to the yard. The other inmates were standing around screaming, "Fresh meat!" and, "Hey, pretty boy, I got something for you." I was shaking in my thin prison outfit, but I flipped them the bird. I had lost a lot of weight in the Graham jail, so much that my mom called me a broom handle. But I tried to stand tall, to square my shoulders. Scared as I was, this was no place to show it. I was just one of the thousands of people who passed through Central's double gates. It's a point of entry into the system for men 22 years and older who have sentences of at least 20 years. I was on the young side of the population, which housed some of the worst offenders in the state. North Carolina uses Central Prison to diagnose how well you are going to fit, how well you are going to do in the corrections system. But for me, it just felt like the point of no return. How could anyone survive here? When I got to the dormitory, there were about 6 cots in the room, double bunked. The guard told me to take one of the middle bunks, which had been stripped bare. I set about making the bed. This was a temporary dorm filled with the most recent inmates who were still waiting to be processed and assigned permanently. Somebody wandered in. "What's up, man? What's your name?" "Cotton," I replied, short enough to hope it ended the conversation there. "How long you got?" "Life plus 50," I said, not looking at him. "What you in for?" He pressed on. Finally, I turned to face him. "Look, man, it's none of your business. I don't want to be bothered right now." He left the room, and I laid down on my bunk. It felt like even God had forgotten about me. The weight of the world was on me, sucking me down into a darkness I didn't think I could swim out of. One of the first things they do is assign you to a caseworker, and mine was an old, balding black guy. His hair was so shiny the lights reflected off it. Before they can give you a work detail, you have to go through an evaluation period. For 2 weeks, you go every day and take tests. Math tests, spelling tests, personality tests, dot after dot to fill in. I know some people just filled in anything. The point was to figure out your skills, your education level, and see where they could put you. "Where do you think you might like to work?" my caseworker asked me when all the tests were done. "The kitchen," I told him. I had had plenty of experience working in kitchens on the outside after I quit school, and besides, I knew it meant you could eat your meals away from the rest of the population, hopefully away from trouble. I chose it even though some of the people I had started to get friendly with didn't think I should get a job in the kitchen because New York was there. New York was a big guy who had been in for about 15 years. He wore a knit cap on his head no matter what the weather was. In the chow hall, he grinned at me and put extra food on my plate. "You a skinny little thing," he said, winking. But I knew the game. He thought he was going to get some. He'd been shooting his mouth off about me, telling people I was his. I was determined not to break. In prison, working out and staying strong is a form of surviving. Not only did you need to be able to throw someone down, but also you needed to exhaust yourself, or else you might never sleep. Back in the Graham County Jail, I would run in place and do sit-ups and push-ups on the floor of the cell. Anything to keep myself moving. But at Central Prison, there was a gym, and I went every day. I pressed weights, did push-ups. A friend of mine would spot me as we'd load more and more weight to the bar. When I was younger, people called me Flat. I was so skinny, there was no backside. Even my mom would call me that. So in here, I tried to eat as much as I could and pack on some muscle. I would do as many repetitions as I could, losing count as I pushed the weight away from me, pushing through the burning and the tearing.
Inside my body, things were breaking down so I could build them up. You have to rip your muscles apart before they can get stronger. One morning, I was on my way to the gym, walking down the long tunnel that separated my dormitory from the exercise area. It was the same corridor they bring you down when they are escorting you to your cell the first time. A corrections officer passed me with a new inmate. I saw him out the corner of my eye for only a minute. It was one of those minutes that seemed longer than it was because something about him struck me as familiar. It was something I felt all over. 2 days later, I was out in the yard on the handball court and I saw the new inmate again. "Tony," I said to the guy who was watching from the sidelines, "take my place for a minute. I gotta go check something." I jogged over to the new guy standing there, trying to take it all in. I had been there 3 months already, but he was just getting his foot and scanning the yard. I looked at the short hair, the thin mustache, and the mouth that wasn't too wide but was full. He was light-skinned, lighter than me, and it flashed in my mind the composite picture of the suspect in the rape they pegged me for. I had first seen the sketch in the paper when I was hanging out with my brother Calvin. It had been all over the news. 2 white girls got raped in the same night. "Man," I recalled saying to Calvin, "when they get him, he's done." The guy standing in front of me looked just like him. "Excuse me," I said. "Where you from?" He turned to me. "Burlington." "That right. Me too. I think I've seen you around." "Yeah?" he said, not sure if he should trust me. "Name's Cotton. Ron Cotton. Bobby Poole," he replied. "Fact is, you look like the drawing of the suspect in the crime I'm locked up for." His face gave away nothing. "Did you have anything to do with it?" I was trying to be real casual, not too confrontational. He kind of smiled. "Nah, man, not me." I walked away and went back to the handball court. Every now and again, I'd glance back over at him. His name was Bobby Leon Poole, and he was in here for rape. I had my suspicions that he was lying to me, but then again, in prison, you can never know for certain who's telling you the truth and who isn't. Chapter 7. I started on kitchen detail, sweeping and mopping for 40 cents a day on the 4 a.m. to 2 p.m. shift. The money I earned went into an inmate trust fund, which you could use to buy items like soap or candy bars from the canteen. $30 was the most you could withdraw at one time from your fund. If you were caught overloaded, with more money than that on you, guards would confiscate the overflow. They were trying to prevent loan sharking and drug dealing. More than a few times you'd see an inmate suddenly offer to go to the commissary and buy you anything you wanted. Microwaved sandwiches, hot dogs, cigarettes, anything to keep the corrections officers from getting their hands on the money. Working in the kitchen had a lot of advantages. Instead of waiting for lockdown and head count before dinner, kitchen workers could eat dinner earlier than the rest of the population. In the chow hall, I tried to keep my distance when I ate with the rest of the kitchen crew. If someone invited me to sit down with them, I would, but I wasn't going to try to make myself fit in. So most of the time, I ate alone. Breakfast was powdered eggs scrambled up, sausage if you were lucky, and juice. They served pizza, hamburgers, or hot dogs with baked beans and a slice of fruit for lunch. Dinner would be meatloaf or some kind of chicken with pinto beans or black-eyed peas. And always milk. We had milk with every meal. Every week the milk came in big bags delivered from prison farm camps around the state. The tables in the chow hall were built right into the floor. Round metal circles with arms connecting to 4 or 5 stools, smaller round circles. The base was set in the shiny concrete floor. If there was a fight, the tables and seats weren't going anywhere. You couldn't pick up a chair or a table to do some serious damage. One afternoon, New York, in his stupid knit hat, came over with his tray and sat across from me, knocking my tray with his. He winked at me. Here we go, I thought. I knew my reputation in this place would depend on how the next few minutes went down. Look, man, the best thing you can do is move away from this table and leave me alone, I said. He stood up and yelled, What you gonna do? I got up. You want some? Come on, I said, waving him toward me with my hands. Better to die there in the chow hall, I thought, with my pants on. Everyone came running over. Some people yelled, It ain't worth it, it ain't worth it, while others cheered the fight on. A good fight was entertainment, after all, something to break up the day. Before anything could happen, guards were on us. New York left me alone after that. But soon I had other problems to deal with. Here comes Red, pretty as a woman. I'm gonna make love to you. Kenny was a stocky guy from Union County who worked in pots and pans on kitchen detail. He took to calling me Red on account of the Indian in me, and the fact that if I was out in the yard too long, I would burn more from the sun than the other black guys did. Also, I didn't have to shave because I didn't have much facial hair, except for a bit of fuzz above my lip. Red, your skin is smooth like a girl's, he would say, his full mustache curving down around his big mouth. He had a crease across his forehead so hard it looked like someone could have made it with a knife, and bags under his eyes that made him look a lot older, although I think he only had about 3 years on me. It seemed like a face trouble had made. My name's not Red, I told Kenny repeatedly. It's Cotton. Show thing, Red, he'd say. Kenny did karate and was cut from years of lifting. He'd already done 5 years, and like a lot of guys, pumping all that weight had pumped up his head. He was compact and always ready to spring into a fight despite a bad leg that made him limp. He was serving time for kidnapping and rape. Other inmates said he'd gotten convicted because of his body odor. I tried to stay far enough away from him so I wouldn't find out if it was true or not. Besides, I always had bad sinus problems that kept my nose stuffed up. My hair grew long in prison. It was easier because of the heat and humidity in the kitchen to manage it if it was plaited. The long hair gave Kenny more reason to taunt me. After I finished my work shift for the day, I usually went to the shower to get the dirty water smell and the kitchen grease off me. One night, I was rinsing out the shampoo with my hair hanging down over my eyes. Like a spooked dog, alarm shot up the back of my spine. The shower curtain slid aside. You got a nice ass for a man. I lifted the hair from my face and opened one eye to see Kenny standing there with another guy I didn't know. Man, you need to take that shit somewhere else, I said, knowing that I couldn't fight. There were two of them, and besides, I was butt naked. If I slipped and fell, I'd wake up with a sore rear. Kenny stood there for a long minute. He made a noise like there was something good to eat. He said, smacking his lips before he walked away. There was a saying in prison, keep your mind off the street and your hands off the meat. The second part was easy enough to understand. The first part was harder. To some people, it meant trying to use the time you were doing to get better, to educate yourself so if you did get back out on the street, you wouldn't do something stupid to wind up back in the penitentiary. Other people, myself included, thought it also had something to do with letting life on the outside go. You couldn't keep thinking about everything you were missing in your old life. Things on the outside moved on without you. Inside, you had to adapt to new rules. If you weren't jittery or on edge, you might miss the blink in the half second before you got stabbed in the side in the rec room or out in the yard. Or the way two guys might suddenly close in on you in the corner out of the CO's line of sight. I kept one eye trained for any sign of trouble, and with the other, I tracked Bobby Poole through Central Prison.
A few days after the shower incident, I was waiting for my turn to shoot pool down in the exercise room when Roger Blackstock came in. He was a heavy guy with a large, friendly-looking face and double chin that flowed right into his neck. He wore gold-rimmed glasses that made him look smart, which he was. Originally from Greensboro, Roger had been incarcerated for a while for 3 counts of rape. He had a few life sentences, but had had one taken off. He became very knowledgeable about the law and worked on his case himself. In fact, he looked over other inmates' briefs for them. He ran sort of an underground legal clinic that Kenny was part of, too. Roger was like a big brother to a lot of people. He was president of the JC's Club there at Central. It was an organization trying to promote being a model inmate. I trusted him. Roger had a serious look on his face as he headed straight for me. "Cotton," he said, "Kenny's been talking about you." He didn't have to say more. Since Kenny showed up in the shower, I knew I had to act. Even though Kenny didn't have that reputation, I couldn't wait to find out if he was all talk. If he surprised me again, I might not be so lucky. And if word spread that Kenny broke me, I'd be a goner. The beginning of your time was very important. The battles you won and lost had everything to do with where you were going to fit in. I put my pool stick down and walked out of the exercise room, down the long corridor toward the kitchen where Kenny was working. He had his back to me. "Kenny, let me holler at you a minute," I said. He turned around. "What you want, man? You've been talking junk about me ever since I got here, and I'm tired of it. I want my name to taste like shit in your mouth." I pushed him toward a rack of pots and pans. He felt as solid and heavy as a tree trunk. I was taller than him, but skinnier. "Cotton, I don't know where you getting your information from, but you better get out of my face before I kill you." He shoved me back. "Let's go." I headed around a corner out of the guard's line of sight. I looked at the wet floor and realized my steel-toed brogans would give me no traction. I hurried to get them off, but I was still down on one knee messing with my right shoe when Kenny surprised me with a roundhouse. He kicked me upside the head near my left eye. Like one of those old-time flashbulbs, pain exploded in a white burst before I was able to partially block his foot with my hand. I scrambled to my feet, my face burning and wet with blood, and punched him in the throat. I knocked the wind out of him for a minute. I could hear him gasping for air even as he kept coming at me. He grabbed at my shirt, trying to pull it up over my head so I couldn't see. The shirt ripped instead, splitting apart like a busted zipper until I just had 2 flaps hanging on my back. Kenny quickly got his meaty hands around my neck, squeezing it hard. I got my forearm around the back of his legs and knocked him to the floor, going down with him. I heard the guards whistle and the sound of running footsteps. Next thing I knew, Roger was pulling me away from Kenny, and a corrections officer grabbed Kenny. Roger still had me by the arms when the CO released Kenny. Seeing his chance, Kenny went for me like he was going to do me in. I sprang up on my toes and kicked him. The CO who'd held him moved in quickly and dragged Kenny away, while another CO took me into the kitchen steward's office. "You okay?" asked Mr. Dunn, one of the older stewards. I nodded at him, trying to catch my breath. "What's the problem, Cotton? Why y'all fighting anyway? Kenny's been bothering me ever since I got here. I was just defending myself." Mr. Dunn sighed. It wasn't anything new to him, I guess. "Yeah, but you know the rules. An infraction like this is going to mean lockdown, whoever started it. Look, your face is all bloody. Let's get you to the hospital." The skin above my eye had torn open as easily as my shirt had, but they bandaged it up well. Another CO came in to tell me it was time to get ready for lockup. He brought me to a holding cell, and another officer came in with a grievance form. "Fill this out," he said. "Then we'll move you to cell block C. I'm going to go and check on something." C, or lockdown, is the prison within the prison. The place where they house the worst of the worst who can't be with the rest of the population.
When you're in that unit, you get out of your cell once a week for an hour outside. Out in the yard, there's a thing that looks like a batting cage. One at a time, that's where lockdown inmates got their exercise and sun. The CO returned about 20 minutes later. "Cotton, go change your shirt and get to work," he said. "A steward told us he heard Kenny talking. I hope you taught that fag a lesson." Kenny got locked down for 30 days. December 1st, 1985. Mr. Mosley, I've been waiting patiently to hear from you before now, but I assume, being an attorney, you've been extremely busy. Well, it's going on a year now that I've been incarcerated here at Central Prison, and I haven't received any documents concerning my case, or much less know how things look on my behalf. Mr. Mosley, it's hell living here. It's as though I'm left without anything to look forward to. I'm lost and don't know what's happening. But perhaps you can tell me. Sincerely, Ronald Cotton. Bobby Poole took a job in the kitchen, but I didn't interact with him. I just continued to monitor him. He had hospital detail, packaging the meals to deliver to inmates in the prison hospital. One of the kitchen stewards, Mr. Chauncey, could never tell us apart. "Hey, Poole," he always said to me. "I'm not Poole," I'd say, spitting his name out. "I'm Cotton." It really irritated me. In the trial, my attorney had tried to say it was mistaken identity, and here was proof. If even the guards in prison couldn't tell us apart, how could the victims of the crime? I had a callus on my finger from all the letters I wrote to TV stations, newspapers, legal organizations, and of course, my attorney, Phil Mosley. If anyone besides Phil read any of them, I never knew. I only heard from my family and occasionally Phil. I always liked Phil because he had an honest-looking face. Every time I saw him, he was suited up and dressy, and he never acted as if, even though he was appointed to represent me by the court, I wasn't getting his all. Phil didn't beat around the bush either, and I appreciated that. Phil told me he and Dan Monroe, the other lawyer who helped out on my case, would appeal my conviction on the grounds that evidence about the second woman, Mrs. Reynolds, who was raped that night but did not identify me in the lineup, should have been allowed in. The cops were sure it was the same guy who attacked both women. If they were so certain I was the rapist, why would they try to hide Mrs. Reynolds' evidence? "Cotton!" I heard someone hollering outside my window as I lay on my bunk listening to R&B with my headphones on. I looked up and saw Kenny looking in. "Oh, shit. Can I speak to you for a moment?" he said. I got off my bunk and motioned for him to sit in one of the chairs I had lining the wall. "Look, man, I'm sorry for fighting with you. I like us to be friends." "You sure got a strange way of showing it," I said. "Cotton, I've been helping out Poole with his case. He's been trying to get back into court and asked me to help him out, look over his papers and stuff. He told me he did the crimes you're in for." Like Roger, Kenny studied law all the time. Other inmates would go to him for legal advice, but I didn't trust Kenny. He was being too nice to me. I thought he might be trying to set me up, so I played it cool. "That right," I said. "Yeah, man, just thought you'd want to know." I nodded and told him thanks. I wondered what kind of trick he was trying to pull, but maybe Poole had admitted something to him. After he left my cell, I got out a legal pad and pen and made some notes for Phil. Poole was a rapist from Burlington, and even the guards couldn't tell us apart. What if Jennifer Thompson picked the wrong guy? If we could prove Poole did it, I'd go free. In the next few weeks, whenever I passed Poole in the hallways, it was as if we were in a western. I was always ready to spin around on my heels and take him on. I watched him as close as I could without letting him know. As low as you might sink sometimes, you never let family see you that way. When I knew I had a visit coming up,
I'd take my neatest clothes and crease my pants between slats of cardboard, then slide them under my mattress so I could sleep on them for a few nights and press them. I'd comb my hair out with a plastic fork. It was important to show your family you were taking care of yourself. They had enough to worry about. One Sunday, when we were heading back to the dorms after visiting hours were over, Poole came up to me. I was briefly shocked to be standing face to face with the man I was now convinced had me serving his time. "Hey, Cotton, that your sister?" he said, nodding in the direction of the visitation area where my baby sister Sheila had just left. "Yeah," I said. "What's her name?" "Susie," I lied. We actually called her Pig, much as she hated it, but she was stuck with the name since she was small, when she'd had a habit of chewing the corners of her school books. "I might like to write her. Give me her address," he said, grinning at me like he was Prince Charming. I didn't want him having contact with any of my family, but I played along. "She won't write to just anybody, man, not someone she doesn't even know, but we could take a picture and I'll send it to her. Let her know of your interest, and I'll tell you what she says, okay?" Poole bought it, and later that week, when the members of the J.C. Club came around offering to take a Polaroid for $2, we had someone take a picture of us standing, side by side. I was at least 5 inches taller than him, but I didn't send it to Sheila. I sent it to Phil. September 30th, 1986. "Mr. Mosley, there is no doubt in my mind that Bobby Poole did the crime I'm serving time for. I work in the kitchen here with him. Mr. Mosley, as I've said before, Poole is the one. I've enclosed a picture of Poole and me. Maybe you could use it." My sister Diane called, informing me our mother had had a stroke, leaving her temporarily paralyzed and unable to see. I couldn't help but think that my situation had put her there. Her blood pressure may have been sky high, but watching your son get labeled a rapist and hauled off to the penitentiary must be very stressful. If she died, I might not even get to go to her funeral, and even if I did go, I'd be in handcuffs with a corrections officer by my side. Diane asked me to pray for her, but instead I allowed the anger and the frustration to grow. The cops had set me up, I thought, because I had dated white women. I'd never raped anybody. I was furious at the woman who said I raped her, at the DA, the judge, the cops, who were keeping me from my family when they needed me. I was sure they were all home with their families, and they didn't give a damn about another black man rotting in prison. It didn't even matter to them if they had the right one. I thought about Jennifer Thompson, Detective Sully, Detective Galden, and Detective Lowe as I pounded the punching bag. I didn't care if I broke my fingers. Rage ate at me like a cancer. I could scream and shatter my own eardrums, but no one else heard me. The rules were different if you were a black man. What the cops and the DA and the victim said mattered, and